opened fire on 8 seekers in northern Gaza, killing at least 6 and wounding scores of others. The attack came hours after the regime warplanes bombed an UNRWA aid distribution center in the southern city of Rafah, leaving at least 5 people dead. Separately, 2 civilians were killed and some others injured after their vehicle was targeted in Rafah. More than 31,340 Palestinians have been killed since the war began in early October. Most of those killed are women and children. Over 73,000 Gazans have also been injured. Let's get more from Moti Abu Musaba. He's a correspondent who joins us from Deir al-Bala. Moti, tell us what you have for us.
Well, Kove, actually, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks and airstrikes against several areas of Gaza Strip. And let's begin from the central area of Gaza Strip, where the Israeli warplanes attacked another food distribution center belongs to the UNRWA in the central area of Gaza Strip. Here in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, at least 8 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed while dozens were injured. It's worth mentioning that yesterday the Israeli occupation forces also attacked a food distribution center in Rafah in the same circumstances. So the Israeli occupation forces are scaling up their attacks against the UNRWA centers in a way that deepens the suffering of the Palestinian people here in the Gaza Strip. In the meantime, the Israeli warplanes continue their strikes against the residential buildings, particularly here in Deir al-Balah city and even Al-Burij refugee camp. The fresh attack actually targeted a residential building at Al-Burij refugee camp. At least 5 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over that attack, while dozens are still trapped under the rubble. In the meantime, another civilian car was hit over the last couple of hours in Gaza City. At least 4 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over that attack. Even in Jabalia refugee camp, the Israeli warplanes also renewed their airstrikes and incursions against several areas. More residential buildings were pounded by the Israeli relentless airstrikes against that area. We are still talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes, are still hitting the residential buildings, claiming more lives of the Palestinian people, while the Israeli starvation war is still continued and maintained, particularly when it comes to the food and aid distribution centers and elsewhere in Gaza Strip. Over to you.
Thank you so much for that. Moti Abu Musaba, be safe. Correspondent there from Deir al-Bala, we appreciate it. The U.S. Israeli campaign of killing and destruction against Gaza continues, adding miseries to Palestinians even during the holy month of Ramadan. People in aid-starved Gaza are forced to break their fast in the rubbles of their bombed-out homes, as you're about to see.
Last Ramadan was great, but this year it isn't. A lot of things are not there anymore. My sisters, my family, our house got destroyed. There are still people under the rubble, and you're still not pulled out. This house was the children's dream. Their toys and everything is lost. There is nothing that we can offer to the children, no food or meat, or anything that they need. We only eat soup and canned food, a can of beans. We are tired of canned food and we get sick because of it. My son keeps telling me that his stomach is hurting him because of canned food. We have canned meat that even cats cannot eat. There is no place that I can go to. There is no shelter, no school. There are many diseases that are spreading in schools. And I was worried about my children, so I said we come back here to the house where I used to live and where I had a dream, and where my children also had a dream, but it became a rubble.
Last Ramadan, I had all my neighbors and loved ones over. We used to sit and spend nights together. But this year, there are no neighbors or loved ones. They're not here anymore. It's only me and the children left, sitting here, and we don't know what will happen to us.
UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food says those countries that are currently supplying weapons to Israel are complicit in genocide and starvation in the besieged Gaza Strip. Michael Fakhri made the remarks in an interview with Press TV website. He said that the Israeli regime not only declared a complete blockade on Gaza, but restricted and denied humanitarian relief after waging a war there. The UN official accused Israel of intentionally starving Gazans that has resulted in full-scale famine in the besieged Palestinian territory. Fakhri said that Israeli forces have also been targeting aid seekers and convoys carrying humanitarian assistance. He called for a permanent ceasefire to prevent famine and to ensure unhindered humanitarian aid into Gaza. The restriction on aid has created dire conditions in the territory that has been under crippling Israeli siege for over 17 years. A vessel loaded with food aid is gradually heading toward Gaza amid growing calls to deal with dire humanitarian conditions in the besieged Palestinian Strip. The vessel sent by a Spanish NGO is towing a barge with 200 tons of food aid. It set sail from a port in Cyprus on Tuesday. Meanwhile, Cypriot foreign ministers said a second aid ship with bigger capacity is being prepared in Larnaca port. Israel's bombardment and ground offensive has reduced much of Gaza's infrastructure to rubble. The onslaught continues unabated. On Wednesday, the main UN aid agency in Gaza said that an Israeli strike hit one of its warehouses in the southern city of Rafah, killing at least one staff member. The dire food shortages, causing malnutrition and dehydration in Gaza, have already claimed 27 lives, most of them children. International aid agencies say the current aid entry cannot address the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. Israeli settlers have been injured in an alleged stabbing operation in Beit Kama kibbutz in the occupied Palestinian territories. According to the Israeli media, one of the injured settlers is in critical condition, and the Palestinian man that carried out the operation has been killed. There's no report on the identity of the Palestinian man yet. On Wednesday, a 15-year-old Palestinian was killed after allegedly stabbing and wounding two Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint outside of Al-Quds. The back-to-back incident comes amid rising Israeli crackdown on Palestinians during the first days of the holy month of Ramadan. Modicon Dealer correspondent from Ramallah joined us earlier with more details on the latest anti-Israel operation in the occupied West Bank. Let's take a listen.
According to the Israeli military, that a Palestinian man arrived at the Beit Kama Junction. It's to the south of the occupied West Bank, near the illegal settlement of Sderot. This is what the Israelis have said, and that he stabbed Israeli settlers there. The Israeli police opened fire, and they neutralized him. Neutralized mean that the man who carried out the stabbing was shot and killed. The identity of this Palestinian man is still unknown. The Israeli soldiers have killed, since the 7th of October, over 430 Palestinians here in the occupied West Bank. And there are Palestinian experts are warning that the situation might even go to a very violent turn, especially that the Israeli military is threatening the Palestinians with more strict measures, with more aggression, and especially that it's the holy month of Ramadan, and Palestinians from the occupied West Bank will not be allowed to enter Al-Quds to pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
And there are new reports of Hezbollah resistance movements and the Israeli military exchanging fire along the southern border of Lebanon. According to reports, the Israeli military has targeted southern Lebanese towns of Nakura, Tar Harfa, among others. There are no reports of possible casualties so far. In return, reports suggest that Hezbollah resistance movement has targeted the occupied Sheba farms, as well as Israeli military sites south of the Lebanese border. The resistance movement and the Israeli military have been engaged in the exchange of fire since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip in October. Hezbollah has vowed to support Palestinian resistance fighters battling Israeli aggression by making the regime forces fight at another front. Thousands of Iranian legal experts and attorneys have joined the global movement of lawyers who have volunteered to file a genocide complaint against Israel at the International Criminal Court. Referred to as the Army of Lawyers for Palestine, the initiative has so far mobilized more than 200,000 lawyers worldwide. Kisumi Shahmadi has the details.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles Devers, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting, as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
and an optimistic Gilles de Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
A South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why, while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape. A very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach. Lawyers believe that we live in a new era in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iran, China, and Russia have officially concluded the joint naval drills which were held in the Iranian territorial waters in the Sea of Oman. Our correspondent Mahdi Abbasian in the southeastern city of Konarak had more details.
There were different operations. It was shooting at night, and then they practiced rescue operations, rescuing captives in a ship stolen by pirates, as well as extinguishing a ship that is under fire, and various other, let's say, operations that are all aimed at building more synergy and cooperation between the naval vessels and the navies of Iran, China, and Russia to provide peace and security in the region. The other thing I have to note is that this is not the last year that Iran, China, and Russia are conducting this naval drill. This particular naval drill, codenamed Maritime Security Belt, is now in the calendar of the navies of the three countries, which means that annually all of them are committed to participating in this particular drill. So the other thing I have to highlight is the open call. The Iranian Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, last night said that all regional countries are welcome, most welcome, to take part in the drills in the coming years, as Iran sees the regional countries as the true, as truly the ones that are responsible for providing peace and security for the region.
During the holy month of Ramadan, Muslims in Afghanistan not only observe fasting, but also practice a spiritual act of helping others, particularly by distributing food to the less fortunate. Abdullah Amirzada has more from Kabul.
The holy month of Ramadan, revered as the most sacred month in the Islamic calendar, is a period during which Muslims observe a daily fast from dawn to dusk. This fast is not merely about abstaining from food and drink. It is also a time for spiritual reflection, prayer, and doing good deeds. Maulavi Niazi says it is a time to do business with God.
The holy month of Ramadan is the best of the months. It is said in the Quran that this month is better than 1,000 months. This is a month to do business with God by giving charity, doing good deeds, praying and reciting Quran. We Muslims should seize the opportunity of this holy month and get united with our brothers and, of course, pay serious attention to the poor and to the less fortunate.
Ramadan is not just about fasting, but also a time for giving to those in need. The fast is broken each day with the evening meal called iftar. Muslims here in Kabul provide food and distribute it to the people in need at the sunset for iftar, a tradition that continues throughout the holy month.
We prepare and distribute food to needy people. This is a tradition carried out every Ramadan in this mosque because Ramadan is the month of the Feast of the Lord. It is a month to take care of the poor. Generous people raise funds for this purpose. It goes on throughout the month with approximately 900 people being fed every iftar.
The act of providing food to the poor and needy is seen as a way to purify one's wealth and is an important part of a spiritual practice of the holy month of Ramadan.
During Ramadan, Muslims unite in a journey of spiritual growth. This holy month, marked by charity and communal meals, illuminates the essence of humanity and brotherhood. Abdullah Mirzad of Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files. The scientists gave no mind to security warnings that fateful day. He had to return from his vacation to teach a class the next day and wasn't going to let anyone stand in his way. After 14 years of high security, perhaps he was just ready to face his fate. Whatever it was, he hit the road and not long afterwards, the news was blasted everywhere in the country. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father of Iran's nuclear science, had joined his martyred colleagues assassinated by the Israeli regime. But just who was Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and what had he done to deserve the honor of martyrdom? And why did the U.S. and Israeli regimes plan this assassination and more in hopes of dismantling Iran's nuclear program? Well, my dear colleague Mariam Azadeh is joining us with a bit of history on this topic. Mariam, please tell us more about Dr. Fakhrizadeh.
Well, thank you, Marzia, and greetings to your audience. Now, over the years, the authorities of the Islamic Republic have declared time and time again that the country's nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Iran signed the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons in 1970, and careful investigations and reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown the Islamic Republic's compliance with the treaty over the years. Even more reassuring than the treaty and the IAEA reports is the clear and strict stance of Islam that is the very foundation of the Islamic Republic. Even at the height of Saddam's invasion of Iran, when the Ba'athist regime in Iraq was bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons, the late leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, declared that it's forbidden for the Iranian military to respond in kind. He himself prevented the production of chemical weapons on the grounds that Islam does not permit using weapons of mass destruction aimed to inflict harm on civilians. Then there's the verdict issued by the current leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, that reaffirms that the use of WMDs using chemical weapons and nuclear weapons is strictly forbidden in Islam. And yet the U.S., with well over 5,000 nuclear warheads, and the Israeli regime, with some 400 nuclear warheads, have committed countless crimes to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But it seems that these crimes have only made Iranians more determined in their pursuit of nuclear technology.
I'm very happy to welcome to Hidden Files two of the sons of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We have Dr. Mehdi Fakhrizadeh and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. Welcome to the program. I'd like to start off with, of course, a very difficult time, the day that your father was assassinated. How did you find out about it?
In the name of the compassionate and merciful God, it was around 2:20 p.m. on November 27, 2020, when my mother called me and altered a sentence that echoed in our minds for 20 years. In that phone call, she simply said to me, "Mehdi, they've shot Dad." A three-word sentence I'd been waiting to hear every day for two decades. At the time of the call, the sounds of explosions and chaos were audible because my mother was the only one with my father. When I inquired about the location of the incident, I learned that the incident had occurred in Absard County. Immediately, we coordinated with my brothers and reached the site. When they had transported my father to Absard facility for initial treatments, we arrived and later, he was airlifted to a hospital in Tehran.
It's so difficult. I can't imagine. And your brother said you were waiting for this for 20 years. What does that mean? What is that like to be waiting to see if your father is going to be killed, become a martyr or not? What does it mean?
As my brother Mehdi mentioned, particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, life had been challenging for us. Despite my father's efforts to prevent security issues and pressures from affecting the family, the created security conditions had entangled the entire family. Nevertheless, he never abandoned his efforts to achieve his goals, which were nothing but the elevation and empowerment of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the country. The first attempt on his life dates back 20 years before his martyrdom, and during these two decades, there were four unsuccessful terrorist operations against him. In a video, Olmert speaks and says, "We wanted to assassinate Fakhrizadeh."
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
And when the reporter asks how well he knows Fakhrizadeh, he replies, "I know him well enough that if I see him in a crowded street, I can easily recognize him."
Well, what about you guys? I mean, did you ever say, "Okay, it's enough. It's too much pressure"?
No, fortunately not. Anyway, a part of these tireless efforts, or as Iran's leader calls them, enduring efforts, belongs to our adolescence or a part of our childhood, which we understood to some extent. But our effort was one of our goals, and we are thankful that we were with him in understanding through mutual understanding, companionship, and solidarity.
You said pressure on you and also your children before and still. Yes. What kind of pressure right now? What are we talking about right now?
In two or three segments, we can define the pressure on the family. The first segment was before my father was introduced and recognized, meaning the time when he was on the hit list and attempts were made to assassinate him. Incidents had occurred, but intelligence and security services and the Zionist regime had not yet introduced him to the public. These pressures were internal and stemmed from concerns, anxieties, and potential losses. The second segment was when the intelligence services began to introduce him, meaning becoming recognized by the people. When he became known to the public, we too involuntarily became known, meaning we had to answer various questions. In many instances, we denied our relationship to inter-various fields, but in some cases, we couldn't deny it, and various kinds of damage were inflicted upon us. For example, one aspect that was not important to us but turned out to be a positive outcome was that many individuals in the business sector cut off their professional ties with us due to concerns that their business connections with us might lead to their sanctions. This was a part of the pressure at the time. After the martyrdom, some of the past pressures lingered and new pressures were added. I want to mention a small emotional aspect, the loss of a prominent figure, which apart from being a prominent figure in the world and national arena, we have significant effects. We heard that during his lifetime, he was recognized by Foreign Policy magazine as one of 500 powerful figures globally. In any case, the world recognized him as someone who had accomplished significant events. This recognition of his personality also existed within the family. Nevertheless, when this powerful pillar is removed, everyone, relative to the depth of the relationship they had with him, is affected. An example is a question my youngest child, who was only 2 years and a few months old at the time of his martyrdom, still asks me, when will we become martyrs and join Grandpa? I emphasize that the discussion is not merely about his removal or exclusion from the nuclear issue. Of course, the majority of the issue was related to nuclear matters because it was a highly sensitive and a strategic matter for Iran. For Iran's enemies, a country like Iran being equipped with nuclear knowledge independently and without the need for another country with the long-standing sanctions was an unacceptable issue that they could not tolerate.
Okay, let me leave it right there because I'm going to ask a question a little bit later about that particularly. Okay. But you had mentioned about his personality. I want to talk a little bit about who he was as far as a father in the house, just his personality in general, hobbies. Tell me about your father.
It can be said that he had a multidimensional personality. When we look at the personal dimensions, we see he was a poet and a literary individual with a strong interest in literature and involvement in literary matters. In another dimension, when we look at his personality, we see that in the field of philosophy, he had his own opinions and thoughts. His entry into the realm of philosophy dates back to his 16 years of age when he became interested in philosophical subjects. Prominent philosophy professors acknowledged that when he came to the Sadr Philosophy Institute, he raised questions and had answers to those questions that did not even cross their minds. These subjects were not discussed in either the religious or university context, let alone providing answers to them. In the field of management, when you look at him, he managed a complex set of operations in 16 different areas. This involved working with hundreds of scientists and achieving results. One of his oldest colleagues and friends mentioned that Fakhrizadeh did nothing during his 30 years of service unless it was the first time in the country or the world.
What an amazing life that he had. With your father, you said that you had been waiting for that news for 20 years. What would he say to you all? Because obviously he knew that he was a target. What would he tell you about the possibility of him being martyred?
At various times, events occurred, and some of them we became aware of unintentionally, while others needed to be brought to our attention. So he did. Of the four or five instances of assassination attempts that happened to him, perhaps we became aware of one of them after his martyrdom, but we were involved in three or four of them during his lifetime. This was because we also had to be prepared for such events. Preparations had various aspects, and we had to be prepared for after his passing. Perhaps the paternal recommendations or last-minute advices are one of the interesting aspects of such events. Sometimes an individual may give advice once, but for us, within 20 years, we're always involved in these events. As if a person, if their death is destined to happen, experiences it once in sickness or deathbed, but it was on the brink of such events every day. Therefore, for us, every day was a final day, and he had last-minute recommendations for us every day.
Amazing.
Amazing. When did you find out about the type of projects that your father was involved in, or did you find out? Did you know the importance of his work?
I have said this in several places. Just as much as my father was unknown to the people in work-related matters, he was also unknown to us. He was never in a situation to talk about projects or the work he was doing and achieving results at home. Even after 3 years, I still hear things about his work and projects that are new to me. Naturally, more than 90% of the activities carried out by Marty Fakhrizadeh or are currently ongoing are not open for discussion because they are confidential.
Absolutely
amazing life. Let me ask you, Mehdi, did you ever think maybe we shouldn't just insist on nuclear technology? For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, we know that there have been, you've mentioned, several nuclear scientists who have been martyred. We know the Islamic Republic has advanced technologies in various fields, from nano to stem cell technologies and others. What would you say, I mean, if Iran just gave up on its peaceful nuclear program? Why not?
There are two discussions or two dimensions here. One is the discussion of nuclear energy, the discussion of nuclear technology and nuclear knowledge. We're not only talking about nuclear energy, we're talking about nuclear technology and knowledge. Today, everyone knows that it has various applications and is among the fundamental and foundational sciences. It has diverse applications and is strategic for the country. Therefore, the country must focus on the development of nuclear science, even though it has been repeatedly emphasized, mentioned, and even examined that Iran's nuclear program is a peaceful program. Unlike many other countries, where their primary use of nuclear technology is for military purposes and violates human rights, Iran has a peaceful program. Today, good information is provided that exploitation must take place in various fields, including agriculture. Iran, like other countries, cannot and should not be deprived of using this knowledge and technology to secure the interests of its people and the residents of its cities. The second issue here is that knowledge, especially cutting-edge technologies, is empowering. Empowerment has various aspects, with the most significant being independence for powerful countries. These countries strongly resist dependence and do not want other countries to become independent. They always prefer to be in need and are inclined to maintain dependencies, reaching out to other countries.
Right. Well, your father wasn't the first scientist, as I just said, to be assassinated. And it was by the American and Israeli, of course, regimes. And these assassinations were not only to slow down, to halt the progress of individual projects, but also to send a message to others not to go into that field, not to do that. Do you think that they have been effective in sending that message to others or not?
Perhaps it was the morning after his martyrdom, a Saturday morning, when I explicitly, in the first interview I had with some television networks, wholeheartedly stated the following sentence: an arrogant regime such as Israel should fear the martyred Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as much as it feared him alive. This is a reality, at least in the events after the martyrdom, where in fact when we complete the puzzle of the assassinations, we come to two points. Firstly, they are are genuinely still afraid of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and now they fear him even more. Secondly, the very subtle message of the Supreme Leader regarding his actions and activities, illustrating how impactful one can be not only within the geographical boundaries of their own country, but far beyond. One could boldly say that he was not just an Iranian scientist, but one of the greatest scientists of his time in the Islamic world. This is an undeniable fact. Some of the work he did was closely tied to his personality, knowledge, and capabilities. Naturally, after his martyrdom, these tasks cannot continue, or if they do, they may continue with less power or force. In certain areas, given his high managerial abilities, his work on succession planning and establishing suitable structures or projects and other matters would not necessarily come to a complete halt with his martyrdom. We certainly hope that, following the explicit orders of the leadership, all his scientific and technical activities in all areas he was involved in will continue. I would like to mention a point related to this matter which may be relevant to your question. At the beginning of the message announced by the Supreme Leader the day after the martyrdom of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he states, an outstanding and distinguished nuclear and defense scientist. But where he wanted to say, go and carry out his work, he did not say, go and carry out his nuclear work or go and carry out his defense work. Because the Supreme Leader knew perfectly well in which areas he was capable. Where he wanted to give orders for his activities, he used the phrase, go and pursue his work seriously. Let the officials follow up on all his scientific and technical work in all areas he was engaged in. We hope that following this strict order of the Supreme Leader, the work will proceed well. I have said this many times. Iran has shown that the youth within its borders are all capable and worthy. This soil has nurtured Soleimani. This soil has nurtured Fakhrizadeh. This soil will never be devoid of individuals like Fakhrizadeh, and God willing, the work will proceed smoothly.
Do you have any final comments? I mean, if we look at the overall situation of the Islamic Republic of Iran now and technology, are you optimistic about the future of Iran?
Exactly. In any case, over the past 40 years, we have demonstrated that we can open the greatest peaks of knowledge and technology in various fields from within ourselves and relying on our own capabilities. This includes nuclear technology, nanotechnology, stem cells, computer science, and today, in artificial intelligence and more. We have international documentation, scientific articles published by Iranian youth in emerging fields demonstrate that Iran is highly capable and performs well. We have witnessed significant growth and advancements, and we envision a bright future for our country. In the end, the point I want to make is that the assassination of martyr Fakhrizadeh and those like them is a blow not only to Iran or the Islamic world, but to human society. We lost a scientist, and they assassinated a scientist who was engaged in fundamental and foundational activities in the field of science, contributing to the beneficial development of human society. These assassinations occur to achieve malicious goals that certain groups have, not for the sake of human society or even for a specific nation. I emphasize that these assassinations occur for the sake of goals that certain groups have. Hopefully, the global community will wake up to this awareness and we will witness the confrontation with such behaviors, the result of which is a violation of the human rights of different nations and a gross violation of human rights in general.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you both for being with me, Dr. Mehdi and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. I appreciate you being with me.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with more of the program. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us. Don't go away. There's more to the show. Stay tuned.
Now, some may ask, with so much pressure on Iran to stop its peaceful nuclear program, with all these sanctions and the sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iran scientists and more, why doesn't the Islamic Republic just give up on its nuclear program? So let's go over a few reasons. Now, one of the major uses of nuclear energy is in the production of electricity. France, for instance, gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy. Now, for Iran, a country with a dry climate, using nuclear energy instead of hydropower plants is ideal, and it's dedicated at least 5 nuclear power plants to the production of electricity. This technology has many uses in the agricultural industry, from genetic modification to pest control using sterilization to water usage control and much more. Now, these are just some of the reasons that the Islamic Republic insists on making use of nuclear technology like other countries, and it has the right to do so. But it's not really about nuclear energy. Over the years, many sanctions have been placed on various other types of technology in Iran as well. The main goal is to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran from progressing, a goal that has clearly failed.
Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear physicist, vaccine developer, university professor, and more, is no longer amongst us. Now he's reached his dreams of martyrdom while fulfilling what he deemed the holy mission of working to advance his country and serving his people, the dream of giving everything he had for the worthiest cause he knew. Well, today, the same criminal entity that took the life of Fakhrizadeh continues to commit a genocide in Palestine. The same entity that accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of reaching for nuclear bombs has dropped over 40,000 tons of explosives on the Gaza Strip alone, breaking the record of American nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in death and destruction. But just as the mass murder of Palestinians has not stopped their resistance against Israeli occupation, the assassination of Iranian scientists has only made Iranians more determined to advance their country through their peaceful nuclear program. Well, Iran has certainly lost a few heroes, but the Israeli regime has lost face to millions of people who are taking to the streets to denounce its crimes across the world. And it's just as Imam Khomeini, the late leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, had said, "Go ahead and murder us. It will only awaken the masses."
More than 30,000 Palestinians have so far been killed in Israel's full-blown campaign of genocide against Gaza since October 7th last year. The war, like any other Israeli action, has received full support from the United States. But the amount of U.S. support for this particular war has been consequential, and the death and destruction caused by it have been horrendous. The U.S. support for Israel's bloodshed has been so unconditional that it has prompted the closest allies of Washington and Tel Aviv to speak up and urge an end to the American administration's blind backing for the Israeli regime. In this episode of the program, we'll take a look at how the United States is liable for genocide in Gaza as much as the Israeli regime is, in a nutshell.
The United States has been using its veto power at the United Nations Security Council to protect the Israeli regime. As a result, Israel's killing machine has been able to keep going unfazed despite the atrocious conducts of war, which has resulted in the incredibly high civilian death toll. The U.S. first vetoed a draft Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in October last year, days into the war.
The Brazilian drafted text was killed on October 18th, and along with it hopes that the mass murdering of the Palestinians would stop. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield said that the veto was because the draft did not mention what she called Israel's right to self-defense. Already, over 3,000 Palestinians had been killed.
Then, on December 8th last year, Washington rejected another Security Council resolution aiming to mandate a ceasefire in Gaza. Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN Robert Wood said that text was rushed and ignored U.S. demands. The Palestinian death toll at the time was 17,400. The third U.S. rejection of a ceasefire came on February 20th, when Thomas Greenfield bizarrely claimed any ceasefire would jeopardize U.S. negotiations with the warring sides. The Palestinian death toll kept mounting, and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza grew worse.
The U.S. stonewalling at the Security Council came even as votes at the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly called for a ceasefire. While resolutions agreed at the General Assembly are non-binding, they carry political weight and reflect the international community's real stance on the Israeli war. But the United States' callous posture and utmost disregard for civilian loss of life has not been limited to vetoes at the Security Council.
U.S. officials have been making numerous trips to Tel Aviv to show support for the regime. U.S. President Joe Biden made a wartime visit to Israel in a dramatic show of support in October last year. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made several visits to Tel Aviv since the war started. U.S. support for the war has been more than those vetoes and official visits. The United States has been replenishing the Israeli arsenal, which would have gone dry days into the war, given the intensity of the bombardments and other military operations in the densely populated Gaza. U.S.-made military hardware of all kinds has been flowing into Israel, from ammunition for small arms to missiles, land vehicles, and aircraft.
While it is true that Israeli forces are involved in Gaza, they are essentially fighting an otherwise American war. As the war continues, a case of genocide against Israel is also proceeding at the United Nations International Court of Justice, what is also referred to as the World Court. The final verdict will probably take several years, but the fact that South Africa has filed the motion at the ICJ and is effectively prosecuting Israel shows how the international community is thirsty for justice. Four months after Israel launched war on the Gaza Strip, the regime is planning a major ground offensive in Rafah. Only one thing has made it possible for the war to go on for so long, besides the Israelis' vicious appetite for blood: American support. Without U.S. support, the Israeli arsenal would have gone dry and the Israeli economy would have collapsed early into the war. In this episode of In a Nutshell, we're looking at the crucial role that the United States is playing in the war. The war started after a surprise attack by Hamas on Palestinian-occupied territories on October the 7th last year. In the aftermath of the attack, the regime of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it would launch a war to destroy Hamas. Almost 29,000 Palestinians have been killed since then, including 12,300 children. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced to southern Gaza, where the Israeli military now plans to launch a major ground offensive.
The United States has been replenishing Israel's arsenal by providing military vehicles, spare parts, missiles, ammunition, etc. The Israeli military has complete access to U.S. spying assets, and the Americans make sure that financial aid keeps flowing to Tel Aviv. Only last week, the United States Senate approved financial aid for the Israeli war worth $14 billion.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden was quick after the October 7 attack to emphasize Israel's right to defend itself. U.S. diplomatic cover for Israel hasn't changed. If anything, it has escalated. Repeated attempts by the United Nations Security Council members to hold a vengeful Israel in check have run into a stone wall, with the United States vetoing resolution calling for a ceasefire to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza.
The United States has also repeatedly called a South Africa-initiated case against Israel at the International Court of Justice meritless. Lawyers for South Africa have been claiming that there is concrete evidence to make a plausible case that the Israeli military has been conducting genocide in the Gaza Strip. The United States' quick dismissal of the argument came even as a panel of 15 judges on the ICJ, also known as the World Court, are to decide, and as any decision is likely to take several years. Still, it is a sign of consternation on the part of the judges that they have already directed preliminary measures to be taken to make sure acts of genocide are prevented.
It is a sign of consternation about the unconditional nature of U.S. support for Israel that EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell recently suggested that the U.S. cut military aid to Tel Aviv. He pointed to Biden's recent comments that Israel's military action was over the top and said if the U.S. president truly believed too many people were being killed in Gaza, he should provide less weapons to the regime.
Aside from America's growing isolation on the global stage due to its support for Israel's genocidal campaign, the U.S. administration has also drawn the ire of many American people as well, as social media keep bringing in unfiltered scenes from Gaza. Many protests have been held over the past months in different cities, demanding that the Biden administration stop backing the bloodshed.
The United States' role in the war is so crucial that it is not hard to imagine the Israeli soldiers effectively fighting an American war. And while the ICJ case is not considering material U.S. support for Israel in the proceedings over accusations of genocide, it is conceivable that the enablers of the war would one day be held accountable on the world stage. Until that day, though.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.